Minnesota State Supreme Court Justice Gordon Moore. Gordon, I have to apologize. This is the fourth edition of Legal Talk. We still don't have a good intro for the show yet.
Yeah, where's that bumper music, Rich?
I'm working on it, man. Right. I really am.
Got to sound kind of martial and sort of serious.
Exactly. You know, something solemnish. You right. know, or at least you know something right. that's serious. It's important. And we are going to be joined today by KYMN interim news director until tomorrow, Kate Kelly. Good morning, Kate. As well.
Good morning.
Well, Gordon, before we get into, I want to talk to you about sentencing today because I've got a lot of questions. Something came up last week, and it kind of tripped some things I want to ask you about. But what's been going? I mean, you guys are on break right now, but there have been some pretty interesting decisions that you folks in the Supreme Court reached that were released this past couple
yeah,
of weeks.
We're our term ended as far as oral arguments go in June, and so right now the scramble is to get our opinions finished, and we're working on that. And there was a bunch of them released last Wednesday, including a couple of pretty important opinions. I think the one regarding sex assault counselor records, the Hope Coalition case, is a really important one. I think. I would encourage everybody to go to the state court website and look for Supreme Court opinions. Oftentimes, the cases that involve hard issues, hard decisions, have separate writings, and those do tend to be the cases that take the longest to finish, and so we're still working on a number of them. But, we're getting through them. I'd say as opposed to last year, we probably have fewer unanimous decisions, mm-hmm. fewer decisions where we had a lot of consensus. Mm-hmm. But we've got some other opinions coming out pretty soon that will be important, and people okay. need to look for those.
Good, important. Now the sexual assault privacy decision. It just seems to me that's a no-brainer. But you guys did actually have to rule on something fairly specific about that,
oh,
didn't
very,
you?
Oh, very much so. I mean, a defendant has a constitutional right, obviously, to a due process and a fair trial.
Sure.
And if there are relevant documents, records that would be helpful for the defendant and in defense, generally speaking, the defendant has a right to those. But the question is, when you have privileged documents, medical records, counseling records, therapist records, child protection investigative records, those are incredibly sensitive issues that deserve protection. And the legislature has created specific privileges in terms of prohibiting those from being disseminated. In some cases, judges order what's called an in-camera or an in-chambers review to look at documents that are claimed to be helpful, to do a look at them and make a determination of whether, in fact, they should be released to the defendant. Do they have any bearing on the guilt or innocence or a potential defense? In the case of the sex assault records, the court unanimously ruled that the legislature meant what it said. Privilege is absolute, and it can't be pierced. There's no in-camera review of those records. People that are going to a sex assault counselor for, you know, really intimate and important discussions after a horrible event should be able to go to those appointments without having to worry that what they say is going to be pulled apart later in court.
Right. And that's what you guys now have ruled. So that's
we have. And so, you know, obviously district court judges in other contexts like medical records, some of the things we had talked about a minute ago, the district court judges will have to, in those cases, still continue to look at them on a case-by-case basis and determine whether there is a balance that is in favor of the defendant getting some limited release of otherwise privileged documents. But the sex assault counselor records are unique.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So last week, I had the privilege of talking with Rice County Attorney John Fossum about a case that a man died in at the hands of another man in a road rage case, and it's a really awful situation. And one of the things that County Attorney Fossum said was that he would be seeking an enhanced sentence on this case, which I will be honest, I'd never even heard the term before. And I guess what that means is that he's looking for a sentence that would be over and above the sentence, the guidelines that the judge will be using. And it got me to thinking, and this actually came up with something else too. Sentencing, I mean, I don't know that there's a higher responsibility that a judge has than sentencing. And I want to talk today about how are sentence guidelines established, and B, how does a judge, like a district court judge, when there's a case before him that doesn't have the guidelines, how does that person go about determining what was a proper sentence? You've got a great amount of experience with. So,
right.
Yeah. But first, you sit on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, don't you?
I do. I'm one of the Chief Justice's three appointees. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission is appointed by the governor and by the Chief Justice. There are 11 members. The Chief Justice appoints a representative from the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and District Court. The governor appoints the remainder of the commission. They're comprised of appointments that represent law enforcement, the public defender, county attorney, Department of Corrections commissioner, a crime victim, a probation officer, and two other public members, and including the chair. And what the Guidelines Commission was established to do in the early 80s was to determine what presumptive sentences should be for felony crimes. Mm-hmm. Now, to step back for just a second, before we get too deep in the mm-hmm. weeds here, people need to realize that the legislature determines what the maximum sentences are for crimes that are classified in statute. And they're petty misdemeanors, misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and felonies. Those are the four levels of offenses in the state. Now, petty misdemeanors are traffic tickets, parking tickets. They aren't crimes.
Right.
Maximum sentence a judge could impose is a $300 fine. Judge has a lot of discretion. Generally, the fines for those are established by fine and bail schedules, and those are typically payable online.
Okay.
Misdemeanors carry a maximum penalty of 90 days in jail and a fine of $1,000. Again, most of those have now been put on fine and bail schedules. They are a little more serious. So if you get a couple of them, you could potentially be looking at some jail time.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's what we call stay jail time. In other words, a sentence that isn't actually imposed, or a jail sentence that's not imposed. People are put on probation on conditions that they pay a fine, be of good behavior, and take care of whatever issues they need to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
A gross misdemeanor is a crime punishable by a fine of up to $3,000, a year in jail. Those are the more serious misdemeanors, like repeat DWI offenses, assaults, things like that. Those do carry the potential of county jail time. Judges have a lot of discretion on gross misdemeanors within those parameters of $3,000 in a year. Finally, we're talking about felony sentences, mm-hmm. and that's where the questions that you are asking really come up to, because that's where I think people have this sense that judges just, you know, sort of can have unfettered discretion to do whatever they want to do mm-hmm. on a felony sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners may read something in the newspaper about a felony sentence and say, boy, that seems really light, or that seems really harsh. And what they unfortunately don't know is the background.
Right.
So the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was put together in the early 80s by the state legislature as an advisory body to the legislature on criminal sentencing. It reflects a decision that was made, a policy decision, that sentencing in Minnesota should be determinate. In other words, an offender should be told at sentencing how much prison time, if any, that person's going to get.
Okay.
In other states, indeterminate states, you hear these sentences of, you know, 0 to 40 years in the penitentiary. And basically what that means is that if somebody goes to prison, a parole board at some point in time will determine whether or not they're rehabilitated and should be let out. The problem with that type of scheme is it, as you can imagine, leads to a ton of disparities in sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens in Rice County versus Nobles County or mm-hmm. Kitson County then depends entirely on the judge. And frankly, I think can lead to some really out of whack sentences. The benefit of determinate sentencing in theory at least, is that everybody knows going into a case what the guidelines say, and those are the sentencing guidelines. It's a chart that basically is determined by looking at criminal history score, prior offenses, custody status points, and looking at the severity of the offense. And that's what the Guidelines Commission does. The Guidelines Commission puts Minnesota's felony level crimes on this chart, and there's a grid, and I actually brought or printed out a copy of it here today. The sentencing guidelines grid puts in months the what we call the presumptive sentence for for an offense. And so let's say, for example, we have a person who is convicted of a felony level welfare fraud charge.
Okay.
No prior criminal history, but a lot of money stolen, $50,000, no prior criminal history. And so under that circumstance, the welfare fraud of over $5,000, no matter how much over, it could be $5,001, it could be $2 million, is a level 3 offense. If that person, that defendant, has no prior criminal history, they get a zero criminal history score. And so the presumptive sentence, given the severity of the offense and the criminal history score, is 12 months and one day. But the presumption is that is a stayed sentence, meaning that 12-month-and-a-day sentence is not actually imposed. The person is put on probation. The judge has discretion to determine what the conditions and length of probation are up to a point, and potentially could impose some local jail time, meaning county jail time. Mm-hmm. But for a sentence of a year and a day or more, that's where the state prison sentence gets involved. And so for the vast majority of offenses, an offender gets what are called a presumptive sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in those cases where a prosecutor thinks there are aggravating factors, and this gets to the question you were raising. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I obviously can't comment on that particular case.
Of course not.
And I'm not. These are very general comments.
Right.
An aggravating sentence, the guidelines list a number of factors that could be used by the court in increasing a sentence beyond that presumptive grid amount.
Okay.
And so if a prosecutor believes, for example, that a victim was treated with a particular cruelty or there are other triggering factors, they have to give notice of an intent to seek what is called an upward departure or an aggravated sentence. That has to be done to give the defense a chance to prepare for that. And if the prerequisite for that claim is there, then the jury decides whether or not those aggravating circumstances are there, unless the offender stipulates to the aggravating factor circumstances or lets the judge decide. And so that's the only way a judge can sentence upward outside of this presumptive sentence.
Okay.
Now, sometimes judges will go lower than the presumptive sentence. That's called a downward departure.
Mm-hmm.
Those are reserved for particular and compelling circumstances where a defendant has shown what we call particular amenity to probation. In other words, you know, somebody believes that this person deserves a chance, maybe a second or a third chance, frankly, and shouldn't go to prison.
Right.
These sentences can be challenging, and these are the ones that tend to get appealed and sometimes looked at closely because, you know, the question of whether or not somebody deserves a departure, since, again, 95% of these sentences are supposed to be off this grid, you don't want people getting disparate sentences.
Right.
You don't want people in prison comparing sentences and saying, well, hold it, why did I get 24 months and the guy down the hall from me got 48? I mean, that's for the same offense. That isn't fair.
It does sound pretty subjective.
It can be.
Yeah.
And so the determinant sentencing with the Guidelines Commission is an attempt to, frankly, make it more objective, make it more consistent, make it more consistent with, you know, policy goals. I mean, obviously, the goals of sentencing aren't just punishment. It's rehabilitation, you know, trying to rectify problems to stop them from happening again, trying to, you know, enhance communities in public safety. It's a primary goal of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And, you know, to try to bring disparities out of the system. The concerns that have existed for years about, you know, disparities within the criminal justice system. And those are issues the Guidelines Commission deals with. So, for example, this Thursday, the Guidelines Commission is having a public hearing about the question of whether sentences should include a point or a half point for custody status. In other words, if you commit an offense when you're on probation, the Guidelines Commission right now and the guidelines say that you should receive extra points because of the fact that you haven't gotten off probation from that earlier offense, or the argument being you're more culpable for that. There's a lot of disagreement about that. There's some people that think that that unfairly double counts, that it's an unnecessary. And so the commission is having a public stakeholder hearing on Thursday. And if citizens and listeners are interested in that, they can go to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission website. It's easily found, the Minnesota government website, and there'll be a live stream of that, and people can listen to that discussion and talk to other legislators.
So it's a custody thing. I'm trying to follow this. So the idea is, if I'm on probation, I'm making some assumptions here, I guess, because I'm not a lawyer, but if I'm on probation for, you know, I stole a car, right? And then I got out whatever early, and no, it's parole, something else. Okay. If I'm on probation and I get arrested for shoplifting, right? Doesn't that just immediately revoke my probation and I go to jail? Or
not immediately. Okay. What happens is a probation officer in that scenario would file a violation report with the court detailing the violation, conviction for shoplifting in that case. And then the defendant would be brought back into court. The defendant has rights to a hearing on that if a defendant wants to have that.
Okay.
To argue either A, that the alleged offense didn't occur, or B, if it did, it still shouldn't result in their probation being revoked. Usually it's the latter issue. And so then the judge has to decide in a probation revocation hearing whether or not to revoke the defendant's probation and send that person to prison, sometimes county jail. And so that's part of the argument against the custody status point. The proponents of changing that are saying, look, we already have a process for dealing with probation violations, and it's just what you talked about, the revocation. Let's let that process go forward. If you know you're on probation for a DWI, and you get picked up for a shoplifting offense, you know, should you be subject to more incarceration because of the fact that you got another offense when you're on probation? I mean, there's a lot of different opinions about that.
Interesting.
I think traditionally custody status has been a factor that the guidelines have used. And the question is that factor currently relevant? Does it advance any of the justifications for criminal sentencing, really, is what it comes right down to.
Right.
Are we deterring anybody? Are we dealing with the reasons we have criminal sentences?
Okay.
I had a quick question back to the enhanced sentencing. How common is it for A, prosecutors to ask for enhanced sentences in Minnesota, and B, for juries to grant them?
It's not uncommon, Kate, for the prosecutors to ask for them in very serious cases, generally involving repeat offenders or very serious violent felonies where there's a real public safety concern. Mm-hmm. How often those requests for aggravated sentencing actually lead to aggravated sentences, that's another issue, because sometimes through what are called plea negotiations, the aggravated sentencing request could be dropped by the prosecutor, could be modified. The number of trials that involve aggravated sentencing requests, I don't have that data. I think that's for the vast majority of counties in this state, a pretty rare event. In the bigger counties of our state, it's not an uncommon event. I just referenced plea agreements. I do think it's important for everybody to understand that most criminal sentences are the product of plea agreements. That's just the way this process works.
Sure.
And by that, people think of plea agreements and they kind of get an immediate visceral sense that, you know, someone's getting away with something, they're plea bargaining their way out of trouble.
Yeah,
that's not what's happening. What's happening is both sides are taking a hard look at their case and making some judgments about whether or not resources and time are useful in having an actual trial.
Right.
For example, if there's really no question about the defendant's guilt, but the question is really more of a sentencing question, then, you know, sometimes you'll see a plea agreement where the defendant will plead guilty, but sentencing terms will be left to the judge to decide after the parties argue about what the appropriate sentence is.
Mm-hmm.
And there, a probation officer will prepare a document called a pre-sentence investigation that includes that guidelines worksheet that comes from the sentencing guidelines grid. And so, you know, plea bargains are just or plea agreements, I should say, are a necessary thing in our criminal justice system. We don't have a system where every case can go to trial. And most lawyers and judges will tell you that not every case should go to trial, frankly.
Right, right.
Oftentimes the defendants don't want to go to trial.
Right.
When I was a district court judge, it was very common for defendants to be incredibly remorseful. They made a mistake. Maybe some worst day of their life type of scenario. Mm-hmm. They want to get beyond it. They want to get past it. They want to make remorse, make amends, pay restitution, get treatment, be better, do better. And that's 80 to 90% of the defendants.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there are certain cases though that just do need to be tried because they're incredibly serious and they involve serious public safety issues usually.
Right. Right. That's something I've learned in the last couple of years covering, just the county court system is that there's most cases don't actually make it to trial. They get pleaded out one way or the other.
I mean, from a prosecutor standpoint, and I was a county attorney for three terms, prosecutors have to have, under the ethical guidelines that govern prosecutors, a good faith belief that they can prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt before they take a case to trial.
Yeah.
Not just, well, let's throw it on the wall and see what we can find.
Right.
You don't go to trial as a prosecutor unless you've got a real good faith that you've got the evidence to convict somebody. Now, the question of should you convict somebody is a second question. I mean, you know, can and should are different things, but a prosecutor should never go to trial unless they have a good faith belief that they can meet the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what the criminal justice system requires. It's a process, Rich. Courts every day, you know, I mean, you know, you look at these huge calendars and bigger counties like Dakota, Scott, Tennepin, Washington, Ramsey. I mean, they need to get through the calendar. They need to get through the backlog of cases that are right there. And there aren't enough resources right now to have a trial in every case, and it would just not be a good use of juror time, too. I mean, jurors should feel like they're being brought in for something that matters,
right?
Not just because, you know, people are being stubborn and they don't want to acknowledge reality.
Right.
So sometimes on both sides, I will tell you.
Right. And that happens. I have to believe that happens from time to time. Someone just... they're absolutely stubborn and they're not going to acknowledge reality.
It happens on both sides. I have seen prosecutors that are slow to acknowledge reality that the case that they thought they had isn't the case that's going to come out in court because witnesses sometimes disappear. They sometimes change stories. Sometimes the test results don't come back the way you wanted them. Sometimes there's actual reasonable doubt about guilt. I mean, they're multi-defendants. Oftentimes, though, it is a defendant that's having trouble acknowledging what they did.
I feel like we could have an entire conversation about this, the concept of beyond a reasonable doubt too. And maybe that's something we should be talking about later down the line. But I before we get to the second part of my question, how do you determine what comes before the Sentencing Guideline Commission?
Well, what happens is the Guidelines Commission under statute exists to meet every year and determine what the presumptive sentences are for the new laws that the legislature passes.
Okay.
And the way that it works is that the Guidelines Commission makes a proposal to that, and the guidelines are considered approved each year unless the legislature acts to reverse them. So it's kind of an interesting reverse presumption. The legislature is essentially delegated to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission the responsibility of preparing this guidelines document that establishes presumptive sentence. If the legislature disagrees with that, they can pass a law that says, no, we don't agree with that. We're not going to adopt that. And so the Guidelines Commission meets annually to review new laws, but the Guidelines Commission actually meets virtually on a monthly basis to go over other important issues in the criminal justice system.
Okay.
Like this custody status issue that's been out there for a while.
Okay. Okay. All right, so then the second part of my question, excuse me, not every felony carries a guideline sentence along with it. And there are guilty verdicts that come before a judge. Then you just have to, as a judge, you have to determine what's appropriate for this person.
Well, there are a few felonies that are unranked, meaning okay. that they don't have a specific ranking on the grid, on the guidelines. And so there, a judge does have to decide where it fits. 95% of felony sentences do fall on the grid, and the judge okay. is going to know exactly what the commission thinks the sentence should be. There are some sentences, however, where the legislature has said, nope, this is a mandatory sentence. You know, for okay. example, if you commit a felony offense while you have a firearm in your yeah. possession or a yeah. dangerous weapon, there's a statute that says you shall be sentenced to a particular term of incarceration. However, some of these laws do have the ability, do give judges the ability to waive that mandatory sentence if compelling circumstances are established. And so you see that debate quite a bit in sentencing about whether or not these mandatory minimum sentences yes. should be imposed.
Yes.
And, you know, they exist in DWI sentences. They exist in firearms and dangerous weapons cases mm-hmm. and some criminal sexual conduct and drug cases. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's very complicated. And that's where the probation officers do an important service to the court by giving the judge the best information about what the law says the sentence should be. Now, judges do have, as I said, the ability to depart from that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the commission is deciding, you know, what the sentence should be, and the judges are applying that. And okay. so their discretion really is pretty limited.
Right.
And so when listeners hear of a sentence or see a sentence reported in a newspaper, they need to realize that the judge is imposing a sentence that somebody else is more or less determined mm-hmm. in a sense of what the guidelines say the punishment should be. There's a range, and the judges can move within that range, mm-hmm. but there isn't a ton of discretion in most cases.
Right, right. There was a case that came, well, there was a murder, a homicide in Greenville Township last summer, and there were four defendants. All four of them pled out their cases. Two of them actually did plead guilty. Well, one pled guilty to second degree murder, and that person was sentenced to. It was a really odd number to me. It was like 242 months or something, like close to that in prison, and it was twice as much as anybody else involved in the case. And I just thought, well, that's really interesting. How do you get to that number versus, and that's, so you're telling me it's just all on the grid, right?
It is.
There.
Yeah. It's all on the grid for second degree murder, for example, depending on criminal history, you know, to get to 242 months, a person has to have a significant criminal history score somewhere mm-hmm. in the 4 to 5 range, which is an indication of a lot of prior involvement with the justice system. You don't get criminal history points, by the way, for speeding or parking tickets. I mean, yeah, I know. We're all grateful for that. No, right. You get criminal history for felony offenses.
Okay.
And, you know, you have to, frankly, work your way to get to 4, 5, or 6. Six is the maximum. Beyond that, you're considered off the grid. Remember, in multi-defendant cases, there can be dynamics going on mm-hmm. between the defendants, and the state, remember, has the burden of proof and has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt. Oftentimes, what ends up happening is that one of the co-defendants wants to cooperate mm-hmm. in return for a lesser sentence recommendation and is willing to testify in the state's case without objecting to that. If you have a defendant who has not been tried yet and is being called as a co-defendant, that person has a right under the Fifth Amendment to not incriminate themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't have to say anything. They mm-hmm. can just say, take the Fifth. You've seen evidence of that in some circumstances recently nationally. And so, you know, I mean, in order to build a case against people who are viewed as the most culpable for a serious crime, it's not unusual that you will see some disparities in dispositions mm-hmm. depending on the circumstances of each individual defendant.
Interesting. All right. Justice Gordon Moore, we always really enjoy these conversations. They're just, I love to learn about this stuff. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us once a month.
Thanks for having me in, Rich. This is important stuff. I want to go back to what you said at the start of our conversation. For a district court judge, I always considered sentencing to be the most important thing that I did.
Yeah.
Having to sit there and look at a person and decide whether or not that person goes to prison or not, that's a life-changing decision.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
And every judge in our state that's in the district court knows that and agonizes over this. Some of the sentences are sadly imposed as a requirement. For instance, if you murder somebody with a premeditation, you're going to likely go to prison for life without the chance of release. There isn't much discretion there. But for most felonies, you have some ability to just make a decision. And looking at someone in the eye and telling them why you're making that decision is a pretty important part of being a district court judge. So it's important people understand how that process works.
Yep.
Again, I encourage people to look at the guidelines, to get familiar with the Guidelines Commission. It's an important body that makes really, really significant policy determinations on criminal sentencing in this state.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Rich.
We will talk to you again next month.
Yes.
Thanks.
We'll be back.
Thank you.
And we will continue on with the great eclectic mix of music that we have here on KYMN. Here is Eric Lindy.